David, if you allow me to tell a quick story, I have daughters now. They're 10 and 12, but when they were younger, I was still flying operationally. And so I had them on the base daycare, and they knew that mommy was a fighter pilot because, you know, how do you know if a fighter pilot comes to your party? Don't worry, they'll let you know. So they knew I was a fighter. Nomex flight suit, that meant fighter pilot. So we would drive onto the base, and my eldest daughter, she was a little over four. Oh, look, mommy, there's the tankers. They give you gas. There's the Phantom. There's there's mommy's Vipers. She could VID every jet on that base. It was a beautiful thing. And we got to the base daycare one day, and I'm pulling out my younger daughter. She's about 2 years old, unstrapping her from the car seat. And my eldest daughter sees a young man walk out of the daycare, and he's in a flight suit. And I can read his patches. He's probably a loadmaster or something like that. But to her, a flight suit means fighter pilot. And unlike most fighter pilot stories, this one is 100% true. She put her hands on her little hips, and she goes, oh, mommy, daddies can't be fighter pilots. Only mommies are fighter pilots. Daddies don't fly jets. I was like, yes. And then I realized, whoa, sweetheart, even daddies can grow up to be anything they want to be. So we had that conversation too. But it just goes to show how important the power of a role model can be. Because if you can see it, you can be it. It's hard for young girls if they can't see another woman in front of them that's done what they dream of doing. It's hard for them to figure out that path. And so in many ways, not only do I literally owe the WASP an incredible debt of gratitude for opening the door of aviation to women writ large, but specifically for opening the door of aviation to military aviation to women. If it wasn't for SHTSI, if it wasn't for the other WASP, I would not have been standing at the ops counter on 9/11. And if any of you have heard me talk about that beautiful blue Tuesday, anyone who had been there would have done the exact same thing. There was nothing special about me. I just happened to be standing there.
Let's back up just a moment. I asked you about 9/11. Where were you? So let's get to that now. Where were you on 9/11?
I was standing at the ops desk counter.
And what happened then?
Well, to set the context, many of us remember what September 10th of 2001 was like. We lived in a unipolar world. There was no more Soviet bear. The world, for the most part, had experienced over a decade of peace. And for our military, for our Air Force, we had downsized our entire military. We had cut back our fighter squadrons dramatically. We had been divesting aircraft. And there were only, in terms of alert squadrons, four lonely alert squadrons at the corners of the United States staring outwards, because they were still positioned to look for the Soviet bears coming over the pole. So, you know, none of us were ready for what had happened that day.
So tell us, you know, minute by minute, what happened after the attack.
Well, we don't have enough time, and we don't have enough beers for that. So my unit had just gotten back from Red Flag, and because we were a guard unit, most of the guys had gone back to their normal day jobs. And so we really had a skeleton crew. We had sent a three-ship down to Air Force DARE ranges down in North Carolina to go do some basic surface attacks, so dropping dumb bombs. It's like comfort food for fighter pilots. And so we had a three-ship that was down there, and the rest of us were just doing the admin duties of getting the squadron back and running after having been deployed for 2 weeks to Red Flag.
How many airplanes did you have there at Andrews?
We had probably 18, but none of us were combat configured. I mean, everything was set up for training. We were taking the TERS off the wings so that we could get back to a basic fighter maneuvering, a dogfighting training phase. But when we go out and train, we don't carry live anything. Even the bullets that we carry are just nothing but kinetic rounds. So they're not a high explosive incendiary, and we only carry 105. So that's the cannon shoots at 6,000 rounds a minute. So that's a second of gun. So we didn't have any kind of weapons on board.
So at what point did you and who get into airplanes?
Well, so Mark Sasseville was a flight lead, and he was our ops officer at the time. And
you were ranked where? What was your rank at the time? First
lieutenant? I was a baby lieutenant. Yeah, baby lieutenant. And I had just been in the squadron for not quite yet a year. And when the Pentagon was hit, that's when Vice President Cheney said, you know, don't we have Vipers at Andrews? Don't we have fighter airplanes at Andrews? Get somebody airborne. And that's when the phone call came through the Secret Service to us to launch, but we didn't have any weapons.
So how many of you launched, and what time of the day was it?
Well, Sass and I got our life support gear, and we ran out to the jets and grabbed the first two that were on the line. But remember, we had three jets that we had sent down to Air Force Air. So number two, Eric Hagenson, had come home early because he had bingoed out. So he had gotten to the fuel point where he needed to come home. So he came home early. And at that point in time, you know, everything was already beginning to shut down. So he had trouble getting back into the airspace. So he calls up on guard and he says, you know, hey, guard's off. They're not letting me back in the airspace. And our supervisor of flying at the time, Dog Thompson, Phil Thompson, said, all right, I'll take care of this. So Dog calls the TRACON, and he's getting this all worked in so Puck's able to come back home. And then the one and three was Shooter Campbell, Lou Campbell, and then Billy Hutchison was number three. And Dog calls down to the Air Force Air Ranger and says, bring those guys home and tell them to Buster come home as quickly as they can. So they came on back home. So Puck, Eric Hagenson, he came in and he landed. And he didn't have enough fuel. And remember, these guys had not seen what had happened. They didn't know what was going on. But when they come in, they can see that there's smoke that's billowing out of the Pentagon. When Shooter Campbell and Billy Hutchison came in and they landed, we had just finally gotten the authorization to launch. And so Dog asked him how much fuel they had. And Billy had just enough fuel to be able to take off. So on my tapes, Billy's taken off and we're taxiing. We take off probably 20 seconds behind him. So Billy takes off and he's got enough gas to make one pass up and down the river. So he goes up to Great Falls and probably comes back down. And then Sass and I take off right after him and we head west.
And what were your orders? What were your orders?
We knew that there was
authorizations. Yeah.
Well, we knew that there was another aircraft inbound from the west.
United 93.
We did not know that at the time.
Right.
We just knew there was another one inbound, and that we needed to stop it.
So, what were you thinking, weaponless in the airplane? What were they calling on you, perhaps, to do?
Well, we knew that 105 rounds of TP bullets was not going to be sufficient to take down an airliner.
Put your mic a little closer.
We knew that 105 rounds of training projectiles was not going to be sufficient to take down an airliner. Even between the two of us, 210 rounds would be enough. And so we knew that we would have to ram the aircraft. And Sass, as we're pulling on our G-suits, Sass looked at me and he said, I'll take the cockpit. And I knew that I would take the tail.
So tell me what went through your mind as you launched and started heading west.
It's the famous Alan Shepard prayer. Dear God, don't let me mess this up.
Wow. So what was your plan if it came to that? What were you going to do? Or what did you think you were going to do?
Take the tail off. I needed to ram my jet into the tail and take off the empennage, because you know the tail balances the lift, and so if I could take off the tail, then the airplane would just go straight down, and we needed to minimize the debris fan and collateral casualties that might occur.
To what extent were you thinking, if this happens, I'm really committing suicide?
People have asked me if I considered ejecting, you know, like pointing my jet and ejecting. And that did cross my mind, but then I immediately ruled that out, because how awful would that be to pull the handle and then watch your jet miss and sail by? So I knew that, I mean, I gave up you know, any thought of trying to save myself, because saving other people was more important. And if at any point in my life something had mattered, this was what would be, what the meaning of my life would be. This was what I had sworn that oath to do. You know, and people, what I was willing to do really is not that special. I'm not the first service member who has taken that oath, and I won't be the last. And I think anyone else who had been standing there that day would have been absolutely willing to do the exact same thing. And as a matter of fact, the passengers on Flight 93 did.
Yeah, they did. At what point did you tell your parents about all of this?
Well, we were airborne for approximately 4 hours. At that point in time, the quits from Langley had showed up. They drug a tanker behind them, so we were able to refuel and stay airborne. We had been able to get some nine mics, some sidewinders built up, live weapons built up and hung on some jets. So we did have two aircraft that had missiles, and then of course the quits also were fully armed because they actually owned an alert mission. And so we all stayed airborne for 4 hours as we began to figure out how to cycle aircraft through and make sure that our combat air patrol was fully manned. So Sass and I landed and had enough time to go to the bathroom. And I called my mom really quickly. I said, all right, I'm okay, click. And then we were taken to the guard headquarters to provide a briefing to the generals. And then we had to go right back to the unit to launch again to relieve, to make sure that we maintained the combat air patrol. And so we flew a second mission that day.
So, and then it continued for how long that there was 24/7 over DC?
Well, we flew 24/7 well into May of the following year when we began to spin up to go over to OIF to kick the door down. We were Scud hunters in Western Iraq with a very relaxed rules of engagement because of the necessity of the mission that we were doing, flying counter Scud. We were also supporting the special operations teams that were in Western Iraq as well.